trickling streams find their way to the rivers, and they are rivers. Rivers run to the ocean, and they are ocean. Blessings fall upon you like soft rain from the lofty clouds, filling the holy grail of our hearts as sunlight fills space. These moments together are timelessness. They are resonance, here and now. They are discovery of who you are, not who you become, but who you've always been. Welcome to Star Media Transmission, dedicated to the great mystery.
Hannah, would you be willing to speak about Jesus and the Aboriginal?
I can speak about Jesus and the Ngarrindjin.
Okay, that's good.
Because that's really all I kind of have authority to speak about. Jesus is really pretty similar to Jesus in Christian culture. Jesus came from the sunrise side, the same as Wandjina. Wandjina came from sunrise side as well.
That's very interesting.
Jesus is, therefore, comes from the dreaming, because everything in creation comes from and is a part of and a manifestation of dreaming.
Yeah, I was going to ask.
And I want to leave the word the off, because
that
makes it a noun and dreaming is a dynamic. Yeah?
Yeah.
So it's not a anything. So you can slide into and out of the dreaming, you know, much like sliding in and out of water, or water slides in and out itself.
Uh-huh. But can you slide out of the dreaming?
Can you
slide out of the dreaming?
Well, no, not really. But you can slide in and out of different states of the dreaming.
Okay, that makes sense.
So that right now I'm in a conscious.
Right.
You know, in a conscious aware state, and my mind is being, if you like, orchestrated by my intellect. When I close my eyes, I slide into another expression.
Right.
Where my mind and my ego dissolve into a higher truth. Not higher, a greater truth, a more pure truth. And so Jesus comes from there and is a manifestation of this dreaming that we're talking about. Mahjali actually had a number of very powerful and intense dream experiences that involve Jesus. Interesting, and just, you know, going, having a look at those again this morning before talking to you, he identified four dreams. And what I found interesting was that in none of the dreams did Jesus actually speak to him.
Uh-huh.
But in all of the dreams, Mahjali was filled with what he calls glory. Filled with glory.
What were in those dreams?
One of the dreams, he just describes how Jesus was walking beside him, how he was dressed. Another dream was an interesting one, where Jesus appeared to him in a cloud, and it preceded the appearance of Halley's Comet.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was another dream. Another dream, he was in his white robes, as Muljali said, like those Palestine robes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So they're fairly sort of visual. Oh, another one was, you know, when he was talking about this glory and about millions of angels ascending and descending. And he was aware of the glory. He keeps referring to this glory. And from then he became very involved in, well, what the Uniting Church called preaching and teaching. But for Muljali, he was just trying, I suppose it was a kind of teaching, because Muljali was instrumental in leading the people back to Moenjum, you know, from when they came in from the Kanmanya, from the bush. They were settled at a place, Wachalan, and then another place, Pantigen, and then another place, and then on the airstrip, do you mind, at Derby, and that's what they call Old Moenjum. From Old Moenjum, they built or constructed what is now called New Moenjum, which is probably, you went there, I think, didn't you?
Maybe. I would have to look on the map.
It's about 12 kilometres out of Derby. So Muljali was really instrumental in bringing the people back there. And Moenjum is in Nigana country, but the three Wanjina tribes, Warora, Wanambul, and Ngaranyan, have that settlement, you know, that little settlement there. Now, Shanti Mai, it's a very sad, sad place. I was there a couple of weeks ago. It's, you know, it's really only in the old people. Oh, no, that's not true. In the Wanjina Art Centre and among some of those young people and through the arts, through dance, through painting, through song, there is still the soul of the Wanjina peoples through the arts, but not in the settlement, not in the politics, not in the economics, not
those things were not part of their life, economics, politics, and government and all of that. I mean, those are very foreign kind of entities that they're actually dealing with, no, in a way.
Well, they are. I mean, you know, this goes back to, you know, just a very basic point is that they are, in their spirits, they're hunter-gatherers.
Yeah.
They're not settlement people. They're not settlement people. And so, you know, we're not born able, domesticated. We're conditioned and trained to be domesticated.
Right.
It's like us. We're not born, you know, or maybe we are born to be hunter-gatherers and then we're domesticated.
Exactly.
Actually, I think that's probably more the reality. What do you think?
I think that's true. I think that's true. I think we're in our most DNA, most simple, most, I don't even know what to call it, but a state that is look at the baby. The baby immediately goes for the mother. I mean, it knows how to go for the mother. That's what it knows how to do, is how to get its food. That's how it knows how to get its food.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And it doesn't need to be taught to do that.
No, that's exactly.
I watched my grandson, Andrew's son. His mother was staying with me when he was a newborn, and she used to lie flat on her back on the floor and just have this little newborn, you know, next to her, and he used to have to almost crawl up like a puppy.
Right.
Over her.
Right.
But he knew where to go.
Exactly. So immediately we are gatherers anyhow. Immediately, because we gather our food, we go for that. Nothing else. Nothing else. Cry because we're uncomfortable, and smile because something bubbled in our belly, and go for the food.
Yeah, but I think getting back to Jesus, Muljali was a real scholar.
Uh-huh.
He knew the Bible inside and out. He could tell you every story in the New Testament and a lot of stories in the Old Testament. And I really love to listen to those stories. One time I'll read you the transcripts of him telling those stories in his Ngarrindjeri English. They're just completely fabulous, especially the story about Mary and Joseph. It's just a wonderful story. But so Jesus is completely and integrally a part of the contemporary consciousness of Ngarrindjeri people. And, anthropologists will say, that this is a corruption of their own spirituality and their own spiritual system. Well, I just think that's a really arrogant thing to say, because the Ngarrindjeri are ultimately the most flexible, far more flexible than I think Christian and most of the others are, because when white fellas came into their world, and when the stories, the narratives came into their world, they just immediately claimed them all as their own. All right? They colonized Jesus.
So in
a sense, the evolution of their spirituality and their stories was expansive. It just literally expanded, engulfed, swallowed, and became a completely integral, organic part of Ngarrindjeri.
That's beautiful.
Cosmology.
That's
beautiful. And we can't do that.
No, and I've also heard Aboriginals tell one story this way and the next time tell it another way. And I was wondering about that. If the wind shifts, if they can shift the story as well, as long as it comes out to the point.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
You can hear a story from five people in five contexts, in five weathers and winds, and they're all slightly different. And when you raise, this is the Western mind says, oh yeah, but there can only be one right story.
Right.
All
right. Right.
And blackfella looks at you as if to say, really? I didn't know that. So you ask, does that mean there are some, is this a wrong way story? No, here I do.
I was wondering also did you talk about how David resolved that situation? Did we record, if we did, let's do it again, if you don't mind, how David resolved that situation with the kid at school who wasn't going to listen, who was laughing, and do you remember that story you told me?
Remind me.
Oh, yeah, the kid was incorrigible.
Oh.
Yeah, there you go.
Oh, yes. Oh, I'm sure we recorded that.
Did we record that? I don't think we did.
No, that was an informal discussion at
Tim's
house.
That was informal discussion at Tim's house.
Ah, right.
Tell that story?
Well, yes.
One of the
really important things that Muljali and I did was with Archbishop Peter Carnley, the Anglican Archbishop of Perth. What we did was we established two-way education, and we decided that we would give, as far as we could, a generation of Ngarrindjeri kids the opportunity to have five-star Ivy League education in Perth, and they would have five-star law education in the bush with the law men and law women. Not only, but we would take Gadigal white kids from these schools up into country so that they were learning at Bush University and thereby establishing two knowledge systems side by side to be shared by everybody. So that's what we did. We got a couple of kids down who really had enormous trouble basically obeying any of the rules. And I was constantly being called down to the school because these two boys were being rude to the headmaster, were wagging school, were running away and jumping on trains and going places. They weren't wearing their uniforms. They weren't doing any homework. And they just spent their time laughing and disrupting and basically running amok. So I was called down to the school and we tried to work out strategies, and I talked to the boys about what a privilege it was. And just listening to myself telling you now, I'm just thinking, boy, you know, how dopey was I? But anyway. So finally I rang Muljali and I said, Muljali, there's something really bad happening. Those two boys, they aren't respecting anybody. They're not respecting their teachers. They're not respecting the headmaster. They're just not respecting anyone. They're wagging school. They're running all over the school, wherever they want to go without, you know, they know they're not allowed down to the river. They're just being awful. I want you to send some of your lawmen down here and kind of straighten them out, you know. It's driving me nuts. Muljali said to me, you finished now? I said, well, yes. He said, good. Because I got something to ask you. We've been telling Gadigal for 100 million years not to run all over our country. We've been telling them our story 5 times, 10 times, too many times. We tell them what places you can't go there. We tell them they have to talk to us. And as he was telling me this, I thought, ah. And I just, and as he said, so what do you reckon? What we do about all those Gadigal who are not listening to our law, who are not listening to our story, who are not doing what we ask? And I just stopped. I said, well, we both got that problem, haven't we?
That's beautiful. I really love that. Hannah, also, I would like for you to, if you don't mind, I don't know if this is what you'd like to do now or not, but you can let me know. I would like for you to repeat this story about women and menopause.
Ah, yeah. Well, menopause has three parts to it at least, the building up, the going through, and the crossing. And it's really the second last stage women go through in the cycles of their life. The first one, obviously, birth. Then there's the, menarche, when they begin menstruating. Then they move through becoming a parent, you know, childbirth. And then the next one is menopause. Menopause, like most of the other stages women go through, has unfortunately been medicalized so that women going through menopause are told that they should be able to expect to have no hot flushes and to be and feel as youthful as they did in their 40s. Ngarrindjeri women know that that is not what menopause is all about. Menopause is a time of change that lasts for about 7 years. and it's signified by a change in the, you know, the your teeth, and your teeth might start falling out. You start getting whiskers, secondary sex characteristics. You know, I pluck mine out when I'm down here, but when I'm up in the north, I let them grow. You know, they're my wise woman whiskers.
Yeah.
You've seen Aboriginal women with beards?
Sure.
Eh?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So this menopause business was very interesting to me, because when I used to live at Gidgegan up on a farm, a lot of women used to come up. We were all menopausal. And we were all, in a way, distressed by these hot flushes. Some women, one in particular, when she would have a flush, she would just literally, her entire body, including the soles of her feet, would sweat. Bang, like an explosion. She leaked everywhere. Others, it was less dramatic. It was like, you know, the one which comes up, goes through. You feel very red and tingly around your ears and neck, and then it goes away. The medicalization has caused the invention of hormone replacement therapy, which is now popping up as possibly having a link with increased rates of breast cancer. Otherwise, YAM cream. Interesting that Ngarrindjin women increase their intake of YAM as they age. They mush it up. So what we decided was, look, we recognise that absolutely everything that happens in our bodies must have a function. Every stage we go through has a function. It opens us up to something else, yeah, to possibility. And so menopause must have a function of opening up to possibility. So we started looking at it as a gateway, you know, like the runes, where you go to the top of the hill, but before you can progress, you have to turn around and look back.
Right.
And you look back to see your entire life fall into place. You don't have to do therapy. You don't have to go into pain or any of that.
Oh.
Just simply recognize, all right. Acknowledge.
Exactly.
All right?
Yep.
That's all. So we decided to find out, well, what is its function? What actually happens immediately before a flush, you know, a hottie takes over? It took us quite a long time to work it out, but it's the most fleeting of images from somewhere in your past. It's, you know, it just comes and it just goes whoosh, and it's gone. Like that. So when it comes through, it's immediately followed by a flush. So what we tried to do was catch it on its way through.
Right.
And we actually ended up being able to do that. And inevitably, it can have been the tiniest little thing. It can be as simple as when you chastise a child unfairly because you were feeling... you had a headache, but it somehow stuck and it whooshes through in a hottie and another one. These go on for 7 years, you know, 10, 15 times, 20 a day. That's a lot of little memories, isn't it?
Yeah, so this is interesting now, because what a woman has the opportunity to do once she realizes that the flash is preceded by... some kind of resolution or memory, she has a chance, she has the opportunity to stop that flash?
She does. When you catch it, the flush, when you catch it, the flush disappears almost immediately.
Uh-huh.
So you know, you don't know you're having one of these memories until you have the flush.
Right.
All right, so you feel it, you learn to recognize, uh-oh, and bang, catch the thought. Catch it straight away. And then the flush just flows out, just flows out of you.
That's so interesting. And let me see if I can get... So there, just to acknowledge that it's happening like that must resolve any question in it or any frustration or any nervous or whatever that... However it hits a woman to get that hot flash, that memory is just acknowledged as a memory, and then the flash is dissipated. Is that it?
Yeah.
And do you think that men have any way of clearing that kind of unresolved, small or big, memory? Do you think that there's any...
Look, I think they must. I don't know what it is. But the reason I think they must is because they also go through a change at around the same age. Maljali went through it.
Uh-huh.
Maljali, went through where he's, there were all kinds of bodily changes, but the one we would most recognise is that men's... it's a bit personal actually, but things change. Men.
Let's just say that.
But in terms of what you can see, they develop man boobs and they start getting a little bit of fat around their hips. So what they're doing is they're developing. We both androgenize.
Right.
Both men and women androgenize. Right.
Yeah.
Women's voices deepen and they grow hair. Men's voices lighten and they grow boobs.
Yeah.
And why that's, this is actually really quite an important thing to experience, because in that process of androgenizing, you become awakened and aware of the profound knowledge of the other sex.
Oh, I think so too. I agree.
So as a toothless, hairy, deep-voiced old woman, I have a much more heightened awareness of maleness, manhood, masculinity,
right,
and all of that kind of energy. And conversely, a man will have much greater sensitivity, compassion, empathy, etc., in what is traditionally regarded as feminine.
For sure. But you can't paint yourself like that, because no one can see you. And actually, you're really a beautiful woman, and you still hold a great flow
Yes, well, I'm just... exaggerating.
I do, but I don't. I want them to know what I have seen.
Oh. The other interesting thing that happens to women in menopause is because they do go up the mountain, stand in the gateway, reconcile through years of hotties what's outstanding from their past, and then shift through, many, many women choose to do this in isolation.
Yes.
What they choose to do, I've sent you the audio book of Tim Winton.
Yes.
Called Cloud Street.
Thank you for that.
And in that, you'll get to the part where the mother in the story, Oriel Lamb, when she sees her sons and their father bonding in boyhood, in manness, after a great challenge, she packs up everything, moves out of the house into the backyard, puts up a tent, puts her little spiritual things around it, all right,
yep,
and says, and lives there for 7 years.
That sounds like what I'm going to do.
Yeah, that's right. It's what I did. I moved out onto my veranda.
Yeah.
And I just had on my bedside table my little personal you know, sacred things, and I slept under a mosquito net for years.
Yeah, sounds like me, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. And when I've talked about this with women, Shanti Maya, like you, they laugh. They say it's what they'd like to do, and some even say, I'm going to. You know, there's this kind of shift to move out of the, entirely out of a family dynamic and a family space into, you know, a different kind of atmosphere, a different kind of space in which you can grow. And you leave the family. You just leave the family.
In India, this is called Vanprasht. And actually, the man leaves for the forest. But when the man leaves for the forest, he leaves the woman alone, and her children are grown. So she has that opportunity, too, you see. And so Vanprasht is the last stage of life, which I figure I'm in my Vanprasht right now. And, yeah. And that's a solitude time.
Yes, isn't it? It's a really... It's a reflective.
That's right.
It's a really reflective time.
That's right.
Are you in it now?
I think that when you're about 55, you begin to.
Yeah, I agree.
The need for that kind of deep reflection. Yeah. Mm. And if you don't take it, it comes upon you anyhow. So.
I think it's really important that you are, in fact, untied from your family at that stage.
Yeah, I do too. I do too. I've been very fortunate to be untied from my family from the day I was born. And also to be very, very, very loving to them. And they support me and I support them. So we've had a very detached and very deep mutual respect and mutual love between us. That's with my children.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that worked out really well.
Yeah. Well, you shifted, didn't you? You went off to India, didn't you?
Yeah, I think this though was very much for what we're doing in this moment.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. I was recently writing about this. You know, my before having children and after having children, all my life, you know, including when I had children as small children, I never gave up my what I call my world work.
Yeah.
I never gave it up. I didn't start it when I became an adult. It started in me.
That's right.
When I was very, very young.
Yep.
And, you know, all through adolescence, it just grew and grew and grew and grew. And then I had a child and it still kept growing. And then I had another child and it still kept growing. So it never stopped.
Yeah. And I think that when your life is for that, if you do anything other than that, you're going to suffer tremendously. I have a student right now who's so engrossed in family affairs that they've just kind of put themselves in a airless little box, and there's nothing but trouble. And, you know, and I think family can be a very growing point and a very beautiful point and a point where one supports the other person in what they're doing, rather than actually wanting them to do what you want them to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. How would that work in Aboriginal terms? How is the family that way?
Well, because there, you know, because there's no such thing as a nuclear family.
Uh-huh. Ready.
And because all of a woman's sisters are mothers to the child.
Right.
You know, they're sociocentric. So a new baby comes into the, you know, the family, into the relationship system. And the mother's primary role in the early days is to take that baby and in a sense introduce it to all of the family in a way that says, move over, make space, this baby must enter your map of our family,
wow.
The Wunan map. Make room in the Wunan for this person. She doesn't let it go. They don't put their babies down at all until, you know, their teeth start coming, their first teeth start growing. So as long as the baby is being held, the mother will pass it to other mothers, you know. And it is never, ever the responsibility of one woman, ever.
That's beautiful.
This is very logical, isn't it? Because when women are together, their menstrual cycles start coinciding, all right? And that should tell us that women think collectively.
Yes.
So when I'm in a group of women, I'm not I, it's we.
Yeah. Of course.
So we are all mothers.
Yes. To all children.
To all children.
Mm-hmm. And that's so beautiful because the children really get the different personalities, really learn early how to be with different personalities, one who's maybe a little more bossy or a little less patient than the others, or one who's a little more creative than the others, or, you know?
Well, further to that, you know, an older woman may say something to younger mothers about, you know, you should do that or you shouldn't do that. But the mothers themselves, with all of their personality differences, don't tell each other off. Now, what I'm trying to say is, in our culture, what mother says goes. So me as mother, if my mother comes to visit me, I tell her how I want her to behave with my children.
Uh-huh. Yeah, right? That's right.
Yes, I will say to her, don't feed them that, or, you know, we don't use that kind of language. Right. We don't say no.
Right.
And, I've spoken to a lot of mothers my age who just say, well, that's how it is when the daughter is there. But the minute the daughter goes out, then the kids get me as I am.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And that dynamic doesn't happen with black fellas because they think as we. And so we has different elements, aspects, potentialities, moods, personalities.
Mm.
The child learns to move and shift and sway and among all of them.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Yep. So that gives a child a big opportunity to understand social dynamics very, very young.
Yes, because there is, because difference is just completely accepted and absorbed as being ordinary.
Yeah, yep.
You know, it's as ordinary as, I mean, it's just ordinary. It's very difficult to try and explain we thinking in terms of sociocentricity. Because we've been so thoroughly trained in the importance of our own individuality,
right.
Which is a complete fallacy.
Right.
It's an absolute intellectual construct that has no biological basis at all. But when we're conditioned in that consciousness, it's very, very difficult to think in terms of and to think in a way where we are consciously and constantly aware of the others.
Right, where we're melded in. I really like the example that you gave one time about, I could see it in my mind's eye, where one person would be like the arm and another person would be like the leg, and one person would be like the other leg, and one person would be like the heart, and one person would be like the mind. And it was just like one huge, the clan would be, or the tribe or the mob, would be one huge organism, actually one thinking. This was beautiful. This is beautiful to me.
There are lots of, nature keeps reproducing itself. I really like thinking about it as a molecule, you know, where it is a molecule.
Right.
For example, water, which is hydrogen 2 and oxygen, H2O, but when you look at that, you've got a little drawing of two hydrogens and an oxygen, which together is a water molecule.
Right.
And if you take away one of the hydrogens, it's not water anymore.
Right.
And if you take away the oxygen, it's not water. It only exists as a set of relationships.
Right, right.
That's it. Otherwise, it has no existence as water.
Yes. I love it when you say that, because in my view, a little bit of tearing apart the small tribe and then tearing apart the nation and tearing apart the family and tearing apart the male and female relationships. And it's very, very, it's no longer what it was. It's no longer that wholeness, so to speak. It is that never leaves a being, but the function is not any longer. That deep coherence, existence, where people care for each other, learn from each other. In that.
Actually, I really like coherence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's right. These are really, 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 really difficult for Westerners to, you know, to really comprehend these ideas of, you know, humanity or our family as a molecular entity.
Right. In the families of the Aboriginals, Hannah, even being that it's a full mob rather than just, like you say, a nuclear family, would there be arguments of I'm on my own, or I know what I need to do? Because, you know, in India, they still select the marriage partner for the man and woman. Do you know what I'm getting at here? Is there that argument? Is there that independence? Is there that lashing back at the elders for whatever? No, there isn't.
No, because elders don't select marriage partners. The land determines marriage partners.
Well, let me say this, please, Hannah. Let's end with this. I wish that you would elaborate on that a little bit, and then we'll end this interview and start up another one before I leave the Sun Coast for sure. Thank you.
Okay. So the land determines the marriage relationships, because in the land is Wadoi and Jungun. Wadoi masculine, Jungun feminine. And that's an energetic relationship, like yin and yang. Now, within the land is a map. If you look at it from above, you'll see, you know, the green trees around the waterhole and the vegetation changes. And the higher you go, the more texture you can see, and coherence in the land. Now, if you if you put humans into that creation, those humans actually belong to a particular place of land. They've come from a water hole, which is in a specific place. They've been nourished and fed elementally and with the water by all of the land that's around there. They are literally of the land, not just one, but many.
Of course. And we are too. We are too. I mean,
that's right.
When we leave our bodies, the body goes back to the land.
That's right. So when, and in the movement around in this country, you know, in the movement from one place to another seasonally and meeting up with other groups who are moving through country, everybody respects the country and the people that they belong to. So, for example, if you're to have a meeting of people, then the land that you're meeting in is the hearth. And people who come from the north will set up their camps to the north. People who come from the south will set up their camps to the south. Mm. Likewise to the east and likewise to the west. So that the pattern of humans in this meeting place is the pattern of the land.
Okay.
Yeah?
Yeah.
All right, now, to maintain the pattern of the land in the next generations, marriage is between this Dambun over here and this Dambun over there, Wadoi and Jungun. So that the people born in this Dambun and the people born in that Dambun are promises to each other. But there's not just two. There is a whole string in the tapestry of the land of Dambuns all over, you know, that are right way Dambuns for this person and right way Dambuns for that person. This means that the human map is constantly intact, and this is called the Wunan, the marriage system, the relationship system.
Amazing.
Is that clear?
Yeah, it is clear. It is clear. Maybe sometime you can also tell us about the skin, keeping the DNA in its right place. I know that that's linked into what you're saying right now.
It is. That's an integral part of it. The Wunan system disallows marriage even at second cousin level. You know, so that the gene pool is constantly regenerative and not in atrophy.
And they must, and people wonder how these savage types, these primal sort of people, knew anything about all of this stuff.
Well, you only have to listen, and I've said to you before, you know, I went in age 26, full of my own importance and knowledge, and within 10 years was a shadow of myself.
Well, now you're a brilliant light of yourself.
As one single drop of rain blesses the ocean, you too are a blessing in the ocean of boundless experience. Until we meet again, I am, as you are, here and now, the great Mystery.